Okay. So, good evening, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. Glad to see everybody. The first order of business is just for me to remind everyone to please mute your feeds and then raise your hand on the participant panel if you'd like to ask a question, and then just leave it up until one of the staff puts it down again. Just same procedure as before. So this evening we are going to start with, we have Commissioner Malcolm with us, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about what I know is a very important topic that members have really wanted to know more about, and that is what's going on with our long-term care facilities with the COVID emergency. So I'm glad to see that she's here. And I do see that we have, I think we have some minutes to review. Is that right, Ms. Niedernhofer? Minutes for April 27th?
That's correct.
Okay. So has anybody taken a look at the minutes? These were sent out.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Knorr. Representative Knorr moves approval of the minutes of April 27th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, if everyone would just unmute yourselves for a moment so we can just take a voice vote on approval of the minutes. Oh, I'm sorry, you know what? We don't have a quorum yet. I forgot. Ms. Niedernhofer, do we have a quorum?
Yes, we do. I texted you. Sorry.
Oh, you did. Okay. Thank you. Okay. We have a quorum. So all those in favor of approval of the minutes of April 27th, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Okay. So, and you can please just put your mute buttons back on, so we won't have any interference. So with that, Commissioner Malcolm, thank you very much for being here. Welcome to the committee. I'll turn it over to you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. It's nice to see you, even if only virtually. Just very much missing our usual interactions and what we normally are doing this time of year. So thank you for the time today. I have some slides, some PowerPoint that I'd like to go over with the committee, just as a starter for our conversation, and I'm eager to hear what additional information would be helpful to you or where you'd like to take the conversation. Hopefully everyone can see these, and I think I'm going to be dependent on someone to advance the slides for me, I think. So I'll just ask you to move to the next one, please. Thank you. So just to start out, kind of put this in context, as we have absolutely expected, based on what we know about the disease and what we've seen in other communities, we knew that long-term care was going to be disproportionately affected by COVID, just due to both the age and the health conditions and the congregate living settings in these facilities that it creates a perfect storm, if you will, in terms of elevated risk and congregate living, and that's indeed what we have been seeing in the Minnesota outbreak. But to kind of put it in context, we also know that what's happening with this pandemic is really just shining a further bright light on what I know this committee knows very well, have been some longstanding systemic challenges in long-term care, just with the staffing shortages, the low pay of the physicians, high turnover rates, all of the things that this committee works on were already challenges before COVID. So that certainly has been exacerbated by these really stressful conditions that our facilities and our providers are working with, and we just want to acknowledge that and appreciate that 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 is the case, that these facilities and these staff are working really, really hard to provide good care and good support to a lot of vulnerable people at a time when they themselves are feeling a lot of concern and stress and risk of illness as well. I have with me Michelle Larson, who leads the Health Regulation Division, and Marie Dotseff as additional resources. I think Lisa Timian's on the line as well. So as we get into it, I will probably call on them for assistance as well. Next slide, please. We have been doing a lot of work since the beginning of the outbreak. And I don't know if I have a data slide in here or not about the number of facilities with cases compared to those who do not, that may or may not have gotten into the deck. But I will just tell you, we've got a total of, as of today, 1,115 confirmed COVID cases among long-term care residents, and 393 cases among healthcare workers in these settings. We have a total of 231 facilities that have at least one case. And 96 of those facilities have only one case, 37 have two cases, 93 of them have more than two cases. And we have, 15 or 20 some that have over 10 cases. So that is certainly every one of them is a concerning situation, but it's helpful to remember, and Michelle, maybe you have this data off the top of your head, the relatively low proportion of facilities in the field as a whole that we're seeing this in. So, but every one of them is of concern for sure. We've been working with long-term care, with the associations and the providers, really since the beginning of the outbreak. We've been providing guidance. We've been trying to be proactive in outreach and helping facilities to prepare. We have had weekly calls since mid-March, I believe. And they're really well attended. Our last call had 1,500 participants on it. So we've been trying to provide a lot of virtual education and consultation all along. Next slide, please. And we've got a particular protocol that when a case is confirmed in a long-term care setting, we start a particular process that includes right away getting on the phone with the facility, with the administrators and the clinical staff, with a surveillance team from MDH to begin providing consultation and direction on what they need to be doing to ramp up infection prevention work, what they need to be doing with their workers to minimize risk of exposure and risk of transmission. And of course, we do the classic epi work of when there's a confirmed case, we get in there and interview the case and identify that person's contacts, who have been in close contact with that person, so that we're able to identify any exposed residents and healthcare staff, get them isolated and quarantined as well. Next slide, please. We have a lot of guidance that's been issued for what to do in these situations, and some of these measures have included, and the guidance has been, if you could go back one, please. Some of that guidance has, I think we're going forward instead of backwards. If you could go back a couple. Keep going backwards, please. There we go. Yeah, thanks. Now forward one. Sorry. Now we're back on. There we go. Thanks so much. So the measures that in this guidance include how to isolate and co-locate or cohort, as we call it, ill residents and quarantine those who may have been exposed. So having, you know, trying to confine the illness in a particular part of the building and not have ill residents and ill staff moving around to other parts of the building. Reviewing precautions, types of personal protective equipment that is needed, teaching people how to how to use the equipment properly. Advice, and we appreciate early on the associations were quick to encourage the difficult but necessary decision for facilities to restrict visitors and to cancel group activities. Protocols for disinfection and cleaning. We also do visual facility infection control assessments by our infection prevention team and provide monitoring tools for the workers. Next slide. So each facility with a case, and we do consider one case to be enough to trigger this this deeper engagement with us. Each facility gets an MDH case manager that is assigned to check in with that facility daily to help them apply the MDH guidance with this particular situation in their facility, given their requirements, their situation, their needs. And that case manager also then is the link to getting other additional health department resources or resources from the State Emergency Operations Center, depending on what the need is. The case manager is also responsible to help families safely transfer patients with COVID-19, either to their facility from the hospital or a transfer of a resident from a facility to with an ongoing outbreak to one without. So assistance in safe transfer of people to minimize risk of further exposure. And just overall making sure that the facilities have the tools and the resources to safely care for residents. Next one, please. So we really kind of divide our response into two categories, kind of the current response or crisis response, and then what are we trying to do longer term to kind of get ahead of this and try to come up with a better plan going forward we know that we can't keep COVID totally out of these facilities, just given community spread and the reality of workers coming in and out. But what we can do is help facilities prevent the spread of the illness inside the facility to the degree possible. The more we can keep it out of facilities, of course, that's our first goal. But we always feel that we have to be prepared, and every facility has to be prepared to handle cases when they do occur. So some of the things that we're working on is getting pretty hands-on involved in trying to help solve problems such as staffing crises to address critical issues. We've had a couple cases where the facility just literally is not able to provide the adequate staffing for the needs of the clients. So we've got a team that is trying to help respond and match urgent, emergent staff needs to the facility that's having a problem. We are building a crisis team to really come in and respond to facilities who are at risk of becoming overwhelmed. We also now have an information line at the State Emergency Operations Center to help long-term care facilities and healthcare workers in those facilities with resources that are specific to their needs, and determining who is needed, who can help, and where are they needed with fast-moving outbreaks. And we're just refining those processes based on what we're learning in every situation and better understanding what the facility's needs are. We're also looking into our own data to try to look ahead a little bit and to identify what might be some higher risk facilities out there that may not have cases yet or may have only a few cases, but have had a past history of infection control issues that we're aware of through our regulatory activities, to be proactive in reaching out to them to see whether they need further assistance to implement the guidance that we've been giving to them. Next slide. And over the last week, we've really been adding testing capacity. But since the development of the statewide testing plan and the kind of the testing compact, if you will, with all of the healthcare systems to work together in a coordinated system with kind of backbone support from the University of Minnesota and Mayo, we've been able to add a fair amount of capacity. Yesterday of this week, we had almost 3,300 tests performed, which is our high watermark so far. We're aiming for 5,000 a day in the very near future, building toward a capacity of 20,000 tests a day to be able to really meet what we think are the full needs of the state, to not only be doing testing of all symptomatic persons for diagnostic purposes, but going beyond that to also be doing surveillance testing and trying to get a better handle on the larger spread of the illness in our community. And we definitely share the priority of doing adequate testing in long-term care. The first cases that we saw through laboratory confirmation in long-term care came in late March. And on the 1st of April, we made a message to our health alert network, making testing of residents, staff, and healthcare workers in long-term care a top priority for testing. So we have been testing pretty aggressively in these environments. And as a result of that focused testing, we've identified a lot of cases in long-term care because we've been looking for them and testing them. And there have been a number of unfortunate number of deaths in this population, to be sure. So testing is a good thing. It helps us find the cases and take appropriate action. But we know that is not the only solution. It's part of a comprehensive response. And we also know that, and I think there may be a later slide on this, that going in and testing once is not that helpful. It's a point in time that tells you what's going on that day. But to have testing be a part of a control strategy, it needs to be repeated at some intervals. And certainly, we do know of facilities that we've been working with in which an aggressive testing regimen really did help to identify and help contain the outbreak. And we know of other facilities in which there was equally aggressive testing, but yet the cases continued to climb. So just the fact of testing obviously isn't a silver bullet solution in and of itself. Next one, please. Because we know what you really need is effective infection prevention and control measures. And that, again, testing must be repeated with some frequency. And we've got a team visiting us right now from the CDC that's working with us specifically on long-term care strategies, advising on, you know, what we're doing. And we're doing all the things on the checklist, but now we've got to go deeper and figure out, given the concentration of this epidemic in these settings, what are even further things that we need to be prepared to do. And one of the things we're doing is called a point prevalence survey to inform how you would do smart testing in a facility and how often you would need to do it once you have the baseline. Next one, please. These are some data that just show you kind of the what it looks like in Minnesota. Looking at the total number of cases in various age ranges, the number of deaths in total, the case fatality rate in different demographic groups, and the total numbers of people in each of these age ranges who reside in long-term care facilities. And so you see there, for the population of Minnesota overall, as I mentioned, we have 5,136 cases as of yesterday. 343 deaths, an overall case fatality rate of 6.7%, high here because such a large proportion of the deaths are from the long-term care population in Minnesota, which we believe is a function of the fact that not only are we early in the epidemic in the community at large, but that we're also doing a really good job of preventing the spread in the general community, and folks are getting folks for whom medical care is more helpful are getting really good medical care. The sad truth is, for people of advanced age with a lot of underlying conditions, even with access to ICU care, their outcomes are not great. So our statistics here are definitely influenced by the high proportion of deaths that are coming from this elderly long-term care based population. We also know that the folks who are in long-term care are more complicated health needs than their same age peers who are still living in the community. And you can see that too in the case fatality rates for people who are in facilities and not in facilities as you go down that chart. So we can come back to that, and certainly you have these slides available to you now. So didn't want to spend over much time there, but just to point out, indeed, it is the case that mortality increases with age and underlying health conditions, and we can see quite dramatically, as you can see from the chart. Next slide. This is kind of the epidemiology curve that just shows you how this has progressed in our long-term care facilities. The number of cases, the dark blue are residents, the light green are staff in these facilities, and you can sort of see how it's progressed over time. A relatively few number of cases in March. We began really ramping up and making a priority for testing in long-term care residents and staff at the beginning of April. And we found a lot more, and the disease progressed. So you can see the case counts growing there as time has gone on. And certainly the fact that the numbers look lower in the last week is not that really reflects reporting lag or the difference between onset and a positive case. So those bars will go up in the last week there. Next slide, please. Oh, and here's the data slide I was wondering about earlier. So I gotta get something out of the way so I can see that. There we go. So of the 375 nursing homes that we have in Minnesota, the skilled nursing facilities, 62 of them have cases. And of the 1,500 assisted living type facilities, 73 of them have cases. So, and again, just to put it in context, that not in any way minimize that this is a big challenge, but it's important to note that it's just not the case that this is everywhere, though we are working with providers everywhere to try to make sure that that they are prepared, and if cases do come to their facilities, that we can do a better job of working with them to keep those case numbers low. And again, I think I've already gone over this, that 231 facilities with cases, and the concentration of a couple of cases that have a lot. They're very large facilities that have, in one case, I think 30% of the residents there having tested positive. So those are the ones that we're the most concerned with, obviously. But again, even among the cases, over half of the facilities, over half of them have two or fewer cases and are succeeding in at least so far in preventing a significant spread. And that's our goal, to keep them in that position. Next slide. I think this is the last one. That is the last one. So that's the story. Very significant part of our response activity is focused on these facilities and this population. A whole bunch of MDH staff have, particularly in Michelle's division, in the regulatory division, have been really tasked to become part of the response team and are working to provide direct advice and counsel and in increasingly getting involved in trying to help solve some of these really urgent staffing issues. So I'm gonna stop there, and I'm sure that triggers some questions for you, and I'll invite my colleagues to join me in answering your questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Commissioner. We do have some questions. I have on the list Moran, Baker, and Halverson. So let's start with Representative Moran. And you just need to unmute yourself, Representative Moran. We can't hear you. Still on mute. Okay, well, let's go to Representative Baker, and then we'll come back to Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair. I'm getting a feedback. Is that okay?
We can hear you. Yep.
Thank you. I think my question revolves around knowing what we know today from what we did maybe 5-6 weeks ago, and a little bit of armchair quarterbacking, if you can allow me to do that. And because we have learned that so much of our toughest situations have dealt with these long-term facilities, I think I've seen that 99% of our fatalities have happened from that. If that's right, I think I got a nod from you there, so close.
It's 99% is either from long-term care or people with significant underlying conditions. So,
thank you, it's important to say that too. You're right. As a state now, as we kind of get our arms around where things are at, from not only financially but just from a mortality issue and the breakouts, the issues that we're seeing, and again, Canada County happens to be one of the hot spots right now where I'm from, and I'm curious, if we were to look at this from a global standpoint, would we have shut the whole state down like we did, knowing that these facilities were really going to be those types of hits that we had? If we can't, but if you could, would we approach this a little differently from just the awareness of where the worst outcomes are from your standpoint?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, it's a perfectly logical question, and we get that a lot. I think certainly we've seen in other communities much, much more rapid community spread in New York, Louisiana, some of the Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin. I mean, some of our peer states have seen an outbreak less concentrated in long-term care. I think we're doing a really good job of managing community transmission, and that's in part because of the stay-at-home orders, which certainly have come at a price, no doubt about that. I think the governor has said that the time that was bought by some of these strong community mitigation measures to build up the healthcare capacity has been really important and I think pretty successful. That we have the hospitals and health systems have done just amazing work to identify how they would surge capacity to create more intensive care capacity within their facilities to deal with the increasing number of cases, which we still expect. We've slowed it down and pushed it out in time, but we are still we're heading up the curve now. And I think we've seen in a couple of our communities the potential for how quickly things can spread. You know, what's going on in Nobles and Martin and Candioja and Stearns and Cottonwood are examples. And certainly there are some unique circumstances there around the types of food processing facilities that we've seen having challenges by virtue of the nature of their work. and their conditions, the concentrated conditions. We've seen that around the country, so that's, that too is not unique to Minnesota. But we've seen in Nobles, for example, went from zero cases to 700 in about a week. So it really can move fast. So it's kind of a long-winded answer to your question. I think we still believe there's a strong role for a strong community-wide response. And we have to, you know, continue to be really extra vigilant in working with these communities where we know there's elevated risk.
And Madam Chair, a quick follow-up, if I could.
Representative Baker.
Thank you. And just also, Commissioner, when our small businesses and our salons, for example, when they show some new protocol to open the doors, with what they want to present to their customers and the decisions that do get ultimately made by the governor, are you involved in all of those kinds of decisions when, whether it's a diner, whether it's a salon, when they show you how a small retailer can serve customers safely, are you involved in that? And how much is your weight on that too? Because a lot of folks don't feel the ear of the governor, and I wanted to know what role you play in that, Madam Commissioner. So thank you for that.
Representative Baker, I'll let the commissioner answer that, but just before she does, I just want to then let everybody know. So after Representative Baker, we have Halverson, Bierman, Grunhagen, Munson, Kunish Padin, and Keel. So just really briefly, Commissioner, and then we're going to move on to the next member.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Baker. We do have kind of an interdisciplinary team approach and vigorous discussion on those issues. The business sector kind of reviews are kind of led by the Department of Employment and Economic Development, Labor and Industry, and Health as providing input on what on the, you know, the safety of environments, the transmission risk, can activities be done safely to minimize that risk. So, and I think as the governor keeps on signaling, he's eager to keep on expanding business opportunities as we learn more about those safe protocols.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. And anyway, we have a lot of members on the list, so I'm sure we'll have a lot more discussion here. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. I want to express my gratitude to you. I know how hard you're working, and I really appreciate the science-based approach and the calm and fact-based approach that I hear every time you and the governor give an update on what's happening in the state. And I'm a big advocate for prevention and public health, and love to see smart public health measures be put into place. But that is not my question. My question is with regard to needs in nursing homes. I think you mentioned that testing is not the silver bullet and we need other mitigation. Is PPE part of that plan, or is it not part of that plan because of the shortages and lack of access for nursing home employees and nursing home residents?
Commissioner.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Halverson, yeah, absolutely. PPE has been a critical issue and has been part of the problem. Early on, there was clearly inadequate PPE in long-term care. It's still a challenge, but we have said as a state, even though the strategic national stockpile is all about acute care and acute care getting those resources, from the state's procurement plan and strategies have been much broader than that to get PPE for long-term care, for our first responders, for critical sector workers. So that's why the folks at the State Emergency Operations Center are working so hard to try to procure additional state supplies to support those sectors. Assistant Commissioner Dotseff is here, and I don't know, Marie, if you have any other updates that you would offer on the PPE supply in long-term care at this point.
Hello.
Come on down.
Hi.
Hello. Oh, welcome. Please just introduce yourself.
Yes. Chair Liebling. My name is Marie Dotseff. I'm an assistant commissioner here at the Minnesota Department of Health. And hello, Representative Halverson. So we have had some luck. We last week or pushed out a big supply of PPE from the state stockpile out to nursing facilities, along with some guidance, instructions, and some direction for them. So we were very happy to be able to push out a big supply of PPE to long-term care providers, and we hope to do so again. We have some more PPE coming in that will be directed to long-term care. So it still remains a significant problem, as Commissioner Malcolm has said, but we are happy to be making some progress.
All right. Well, thank you so much. So just to let everybody know, I've been told the commissioner needs to be done at 5:15. And so we have Bierman, Grunhagen, Munson, Kunish Padin, and Keel. So Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. Thanks for the update on everything that you're doing in regards to long-term care. It's good to hear about the case managers being assigned immediately and the response teams and looking at care centers that might be suspect and the focus you're putting on that. And I know infection control is central, and then that early detection is so important, because once the COVID spreads, these most vulnerable, you know, they we need to know as quickly as possible what their condition is. So my question is, with the increase in testing, you know, we're looking at 80-90% of the cases that pass are from these vulnerable residents. Are we pushing enough testing to the care centers in a timely fashion where we're staying ahead of that as possible? Is there a number of testing that you're focusing on for the care centers? And I have one follow-up too, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, I think the way we've been approaching it, and again, we're just consulting with CDC on this as we speak, is that we do targeted testing. Absolutely, it's a priority to test all symptomatic people and to have really a very low threshold for testing. So, you know, maybe earlier in the outbreak, it was a little more restrictive. You know, you had to have the following five symptoms plus a fever. Well, now it's like any symptom should trigger availability of testing for symptomatic folks. And we're also looking now, now knowing the role of asymptomatic transmission, which was something we didn't know 6 weeks ago. We're also being a little more inclusive of what we consider to be a contact at risk, and testing there as well if those persons are in need of testing. So there's not a there are situations in which we would recommend broader testing in a nursing home, in a population that's assisted living as well, of course. But it's not our thinking at this point that we ought to just proactively go test everyone in every facility. But that's not what we're recommending, in part because testing is in limited supply, and partly because of what that would and wouldn't tell you. Again, it's a point in time. So we still feel like focusing on the symptomatic, but doing so with a low threshold and really quickly is the way to go.
Thank you. And okay. Madam Chair, one more question. And this is in regards to COVID patients that maybe are through the worst of it in a facility, in a hospital, for instance, and transferring of those patients to long-term facilities for recovery. Is it policy? I know a lot of facilities have made space available for COVID patients, but is it a policy to keep COVID out of long-term facilities that have not had any cases yet? Or are you confident that they can be transferred into those facilities? And I just am looking for guidelines if there are any at MDH right now on that issue.
Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bierman. Yes, it's a great question, and we are really grateful for those facilities that have volunteered to provide COVID support care for people coming out of the hospital or people who can't be safely cared for where they are. And that tends to be facilities that have extra space available, maybe a wing or something that can be safely dedicated to COVID care. I'm looking at Marie, but I do not believe that we have any sort of guidance that says that a facility with no cases shouldn't take cases. We don't have guidance like that. Yeah, it's really more about the capability of the facility, their staffing levels, the presence of clinical staff, and their capability to provide the care.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Grunhagen, are you still with us here? Okay. I don't think he's still on the call. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Malcolm. Thank you for taking some questions today. My first one is about the safety of both the patients and the workers in long-term care facilities. I learned from speaking to some nurses that there's guidelines within certain facilities, and I'm wondering if they're coming from the Department of Health, that if a patient tests positive for COVID, that they have kind of a DNR on their record, even though they may have a full code on their advanced directives, that CPR, because CPR is considered an aerosol generating procedure, that they're told not to perform CPR on someone who's diagnosed with, who tests positive for COVID. Is that a guideline from MDH, or is that just up to the facilities or the hospitals that are stating this?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, I'm certainly unaware of any such policy. I'm looking at my colleagues, and we certainly will follow up and ask about that. But that would surprise me greatly if that was a hospital-driven policy either. But I will have to check and get back to you. I'd be really surprised. But I can't speak with full confidence about that right now.
Right. And okay. Commissioner, my reaction is I would be shocked if the state had such a policy. I just cannot imagine that would be the case. So, I cannot imagine that individual hospitals would have that kind of a policy either. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you for all the information that you've given us, Commissioner. I lost a father-in-law to the virus, and I have a mother-in-law in Rochester who, in her long-term care facility, there are no instances of the virus, and none of the employees have it. So that is one of the success stories about keeping everybody far apart and keeping folks safe. But my question for you is around communities of color. Many of them have some of the highest health disparities, outside of something like this. When you look at Navajo Nation, they have those alarming numbers of cases. Can you speak a little bit to the communities about communities of color here in Minnesota and how they are faring through this? It doesn't have to be real in depth, but just a quick overview so that we understand.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein. It's an excellent question, and we know that populations of color, Native Americans, are at disproportionately greater risk precisely because of the other health inequities that existed pre-COVID. So they are absolutely more vulnerable to severe incidence of the disease. Perhaps not more likely to get it at all, but to have a more severe course of the disease. We are tracking the data and are beginning to have enough numbers where the racial and ethnic breakdowns are statistically relevant, and we are seeing a little bit of overrepresentation in the case counts and in the hospitalizations among African American population in particular at this point, and some in the Native American community. So we're seeing a little bit of overrepresentation in the hospitalization. So far, I believe, and that don't have that data right in front of me right now, I don't think we're seeing a disproportion in the death statistics, but in the hospitalizations we are. But we're definitely know that we need to be doing better outreach, more education in those communities, because I think a lot of folks don't quite appreciate yet that pre-existing health conditions creates a greater risk for them than just the general population. So we're not sure that people are fully aware yet of the risk that they may be facing. And we need to work with community leaders and community groups to be making sure that those messages are getting out, not just relying on material that's on the MDH website. We know that's not adequate community outreach. But we have a pretty robust community engagement team here that is working hard to get into the communities and work with the providers, the community clinics, and community-based organizations that are serving them.
Thank you. I appreciate your response and the work that MDH and the governor across the board are doing. So thanks much.
Thank you. I appreciate that the department is reporting that data by race every day. So that's helpful as well. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the time. And the Commissioner Malcolm, appreciate your work and all that you're doing, because I can't imagine how you sleep sometimes at night with all the stuff going on. But what I would like to know, I have a couple of questions. My first one is, my hospitals are telling me, my rural, that they would like to be able to test nursing home patients or somebody that may have to have surgery, but they have to ship those down because they have some of the testing equipment, but they don't have an adequate supply of, like, cartridges and swabs. Are we getting better at managing that? And I apologize, I missed the first part of your presentation. We had double-up meetings, so.
Right. And I know the commissioner has to get going, too. Yes. I think we're a couple minutes over. Commissioner, could staff take over? I mean, I'll leave it up to you if you need to go and put in, maybe Ms. Dotseff could take it over for you.
Sure. I thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Keel. And I meant to, and I've neglected Representative Kanesh Boudin to say it. I'm so sorry for the loss of your father. And every one of these losses is a heartbreak for family. So Representative Keel, yes, the testing strategy and the testing partnership that we announced last week is very much intended to support building up the capacity of local providers too. It's not meant to take testing away from providers and centralize them all, but it is meant to help get supplies to providers to support them in doing the collection. And if providers have laboratory capacity of their own or nearby, that we want to keep the testing as close to the patients as possible. But Mayo and the U are serving as kind of the backup labs to process the tests that are collected where there isn't that capacity nearby locally. But yes, we are working hard to procure more of the testing supplies, the transport media, the swabs that providers need to be doing this collection. Because you're right, it's both ends. It's collection that needs to happen, mm-hmm. and processing at the back end.
Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Keel.
Commissioner Malcolm, my understanding is they would be able to, the difference is between 15 minutes of identifying and 24 hours of sending it away. So just with that thought and process in mind, they're able to handle it. The other question I had was just a real quick, you talked to Representative Bierman about this, but is it mandatory for long-term facilities to take in patients, or is it just if they want to, if there's a bed, if they're able to handle it?
Commissioner.
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative Keel, correct. We are not in the business, have not been, of requiring anybody to take cases that they're not able to take. I'm not familiar with, but it's certainly possible that in other states, governors are using executive orders in all kinds of ways to require capacity to be built where it doesn't exist, but we are not in that situation at this juncture.
All right, thank you. And Representative Schultz also has a question. Commissioner, can you stay for another moment?
Just a couple minutes.
Great. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, Commissioner, and all your staff for the great work you're doing. Just have a question. Are you or your staff, are you noticing any patterns or trends or obvious factors where there are substantial outbreaks in facilities versus limited outbreaks? Is there anything similar about the facilities where there's larger outbreaks?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, we're digging into that data right now, and I'm sorry I don't yet have a report from the CDC team that's here, because we're looking for some of their insights on into that too. What are the factors that may be causing some facilities to have a harder time? Certainly we know, you know, some I think one thing we also like to say is that just because there are cases in a facility doesn't necessarily mean the facility did something wrong. I mean, I think this disease was circulating in the community and in our facilities long before anybody knew about it. We now know a lot more than we did before, and we're developing, you know, better capabilities to respond quickly. But infection control practices certainly have been a critical variable. And I think speed of adopting some of the guidance has been a variable that, you know, we've given a lot of guidance. One of the things that we're beginning to work on now is that, you know, guidance is good, and we have taken much more of a consultative approach than a regulatory kind of enforcement approach, but we're thinking pretty seriously about doing more than giving guidance and actually being a little more directive, that this isn't just a suggestion, it's a requirement that you need to do X, Y, and Z on the infection control front, for example.
Representative Schultz?
Thank you for that, Commissioner. Okay. And also, I've been getting questions from communities where there are big outbreaks in a long-term care facility. Are you able to test even non-symptomatic, like staff? And so if you test, because some of them think that the staff are bringing it in, but they're not symptomatic. So are you able to test those individuals even though they don't have symptoms?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, that's a good example of, you know, a kind of a situation-specific response to when is broader testing indicated, and it might be if there's a significant number of cases that you would be doing testing of asymptomatic people in certain situations like that. So it's not a hard and fast rule that we say always do it or never do it. It's really more situation specific.
Okay. All right. Well, Commissioner, thank you so much for joining us today.
Specific facility.
Sorry, I think I'm getting a little interference. I don't know if other people are as well. I think so. So, all right.
Thank
well,
you. I'm having a little message.
Yeah, we're having a little technical problem now with you, Commissioner, but thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate it. And we know that if members
thank you
have
for the time. It's nice to see you all.
Thank
however,
you.
Remotely.
All right. Thank you for your great work. We appreciate it so much. All right. So members, we have two bills on the list. We are gonna take up House File 4582, which is the Halverson bill that we discussed and took testimony on in our last meeting. And Representative Halverson, are you there?
I'm here.
See you. Okay, excellent. So Representative Halverson is going to move House File 4582 to be re-referred to Ways and Means. And I understand there's an author's amendment, Representative Halverson.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, so Representative Halverson moves the A1 amendment. Could you just briefly explain what the A1 amendment does?
I will. The A1 amendment reduces the general fund appropriation $98,000. It had been in the neighborhood of $5 million, but working with the department, we found ways to align how the work was going to be done. And that also includes some money for IT for program changes. So it reduces the general fund appropriation.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Is there any discussion to the A1 author's amendment? All right. Let's see. Okay. Seeing none, then if everyone would just unmute, I think we could just do an oral vote on this one. So all those in favor of the A1 or author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. And then to the House File 4582 as amended, is there any other discussion? Okay, not seeing any. So, all right, then I think we're ready to vote on the bill. And on this one, we will do we're going to do a roll call because I understand that's kind of how we have to proceed with these remote hearings. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, please call the roll. The chair votes aye.
Schumacher. Akam.
Aye.
Baker.
Aye.
Bierman.
Aye.
Cantrell. Cantrell. Franson.
Pass.
Grunhagen. Haley. Haley. Halverson.
Aye.
Hamilton.
Aye.
Jordan.
Aye.
Keel. Keel.
Aye.
Kunish Padin.
Aye.
Mann.
Aye.
Moran. Moran. Munson?
Sorry, this is 4582. Is that what we're voting on?
Correct.
Yes.
Okay. I'm no.
Noor?
Yes.
Olson?
Aye.
Schultz?
Aye.
I'm going to go back to the ones who weren't there. Schumacher?
Ms. Niedernhofer, let's go around and set didn't answer just to make sure that everyone can get an opportunity to vote who wants to.
Schumacher. Cantrell. Grunhagen. Haley.
Aye.
Moran.
Cantrell is motioning aye. I don't think his audio is working.
Oh, yes. Cantrell is aye.
He was waving thumbs up, jumping up and down.
Okay. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I Baker here. I also thought we were doing something different, and I was actually would like to be a no vote on this. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I misunderstood. Is that okay?
All right. Baker changes from aye to no.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is Representative Keel.
Yes, please.
I'm also going to vote no on this.
Okay, Representative Keel changes from aye to no. All right.
Madam Chair, this is Representative Haley. I would change to a no.
Okay, should we start over? I just kind of wonder why is everybody's changing? We really rarely do this in committee. So is there confusion about what we were voting on?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's why
okay.
I passed.
All right. Thank you for letting me know that. Okay, let's just, Ms. Niedernhofer, why don't we just quickly go through the roll again, given that there was confusion. So we're on the Halverson bill, House File 4582, chair votes aye.
Schumacher. Akam.
Aye.
Baker.
No.
Bierman.
Yes.
Cantrell.
Cantrell votes aye.
Franson.
No.
Grunhagen. Haley.
No.
Halverson.
Aye.
Hamilton.
No.
Jordan.
Aye.
Keel.
No.
Kunish Padin. Kunish Padin. Mann.
Hi.
This is Kunish Padin. Did you get my yes?
No, I didn't. Okay, thank you. Moran.
Hi.
Munson.
No.
Noor.
Yes.
Olson.
Aye.
Stoltz.
Aye.
Yeah.
There being 12 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 4582 is on its way to Ways and Means. Okay, we will now take up House File 4601, which is Representative Cagle, and Representative Cagle is going to present the bill along with some help from Representative Baker, I understand. So, Representative Cagle, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So House File 4601 is recommendations from the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. This bill came about. We wanted to make sure that we were getting the funding out from the special account that was established by last year's opioid epidemic legislation. So we wanted to make sure that we could get that funding out as quickly as possible. So through the committee through the council process, the council made recommendations to get 50% of the 2021 funding out to organizations that had already gone through the DHS RFP process. And so that is where this bill came about. And these are the recommendations from the council to get that funding out as soon as possible.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cagle. And we forgot to move the bill. That would be important. So how about if Representative Baker moves that House File 4601 be re-referred to Ways and Means. So now we have the bill officially before us. And Representative Baker, do you want to add to
just
to
maybe a quick comment again? Thank you, Representative Cagle. Her and I served together on the Opioid Council. We have worked really hard to get the funding out to communities. And again, we have roughly 4.5 to 5 million this year to work with. And we took about half of it now, this $2.7 million to community grants that will go directly to folks that have worked with addiction, opioid processes before. But we wanted to get this money out quickly because these communities never got money last year from funding because we really were focused on this opioid council, but it took us a little bit longer to get us out and running. So this would be likely the only time we'll come in front of the legislature to ask for these direct appropriations from this opioid council fund. So with that, Madam Chair, I think we stand for questions, but these organizations that you see listed in front of you are in the pipeline doing good work already, and the council is really busy getting more funding and granting out later this summer. So we're off and running and doing good work because of a lot of our support on that past bill with Liz Olson, Representative Olson on that too. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Baker. So we have two members with questions or comments. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Cagle and Baker, for your work on this. I just was going to ask a clarifying question, but I think Representative Baker said it, that this isn't a precedent that the council is looking to set. This is because of the urgency of the situation we're in, because the charge is really for the opioid response counsel to be the ones making the recommendations on appropriations and not the legislature. So I just, you clarified that. And to that point, I think you, both of you are on the council, but this is something that the council knows is happening and is agreeing upon that this is the best approach. Is that correct? And with that, with those being answered, I fully support this and appreciate their work.
All right. Thank you, Representative Olson. And Representative Munson is on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cagle, I had a question on how many organizations reached out for money. Is this are we making decisions here to give money to certain groups and not to others, or just these are the ones that are recommended by the council? Or can you explain the process and how you came up with this amount of money and how it's only going to these organizations?
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Munson. So this was a long this was a long process of going through. We kind of put together a bunch of different buckets of where we wanted this funding to go and to work on different aspects of the opioid crisis. And so what we did is these were strictly recommendations from the council. We wanted to make sure that these organizations were accountable and vetted by DHS. And so these are organizations that have already gotten grants through DHS. And it was strictly a council decision to recommend these organizations.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Baker.
Only to clarify, too, I know it sounds like Claire is having fun over there with Representative Cagle. Great question from Representative Munson regarding these folks have received money before, but they did not go through the grant process for this first round because of the urgency aspect of it. So normally we are having this, the DHS granting process, very detailed, setting it up. We're on a fast track now for doing some granting in June and July, to be executed in September. A lot of the folks that you're seeing here actually had received grants the last couple of years. There's some ECHO projects in here. There's medically assisted treatments. There are some folks working with culturally specific groups. So we selected these because they're grants, number one. Most of them were running out in this April. So we're able to continue their work that they have been doing for some time now. But because we could take about half of this time and get it out quickly, we didn't want to do any more than that because we want to make sure the granting process is working for the next round and all future rounds after that. So excellent question. Thank you for that.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify, this is coming out of the opioid fund. I don't know if I have the right terminology for the fund, but it's in this committee because the fund is under our jurisdiction, but we in fact have never done anything with this fund and expect not to be in the future, but this is under our jurisdiction, which is why it's here. And then can anybody tell me how much is in the fund? I don't know if Mr. Berg should be on the call, or maybe one of the members knows that.
I think roughly, go ahead.
Well, what, Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, members, the projected revenue to the fund is a total of $20,940,000 in fiscal 2020, but I believe, I haven't checked this in the last couple of weeks, the last I knew there was no money in the fund because it's expected that the fee is going to be collected at the last minute, that the companies will pay at the very end of the period they have it. So the anticipated amount is $20,940,000 for fiscal year 20, which will carry over into 21 and be available for grants.
And maybe I can answer that too. I think the Board of Pharmacy is collecting the fees that are coming in now, Madam Chair. I've been told it's in that $18 million range right now, and there's a one-time transfer from the Board of Pharmacy, or if I have that fund wrong, Mr. Berg, you can correct me, but then it makes that one-time transfer to the Opioid Council or the Stewardship Fund. So we made some changes with the medical gases. We lowered those fees quite a bit by about $800,000. So if everything comes in like we expect, it'll be more closer to $19.5 million. That'll be a one-time transfer to that fund, but that'll happen, I think, around the middle of June or first part of June. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. So is there any more discussion? All right. Seeing none, I was told that this bill is as amended too, but I don't know. Was this amended? No. Okay. So Representative Baker is going to renew his motion that House File 4601 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. So the clerk will take the roll on the bill, and the chair votes aye. And you'll just need to unmute yourselves, members.
Schumacher. Akam.
Aye.
Baker.
Aye.
Bierman.
Aye.
Cantrell.
He's having trouble with his audio.
Aye.
Oh, there he is.
Aye.
Gotcha.
Branson.
Aye.
Grunhagen. Haley.
Aye.
Halverson.
Aye.
Hamilton.
Aye.
Jordan.
Aye.
Keel.
Aye.
Kunesh-Podein.
Aye.
Mann.
Aye.
Moran.
Aye.
Munson.
Aye.
Noor.
Yes.
Olson.
Aye.
And Schultz.
Aye.
Thank you.
So there being 18 ayes and 0 nays, the bill is passed and it is on its way to Ways and Means. So thank you very much, members. This is somewhat of an awkward procedure always, but, you know, I appreciate everybody's indulgence. I think we've done okay. And thank you also for being willing to meet at this, not our regular time. Unfortunately, our regular time got preempted by another committee. So, we're going to do our best to be meeting during our regular times just to make it more convenient for all of you. But thank you very much. If there's no further concerns, I'm not seeing any, we are adjourned. Have a great evening.